for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.
Nazism draws from a deeper wellspring of Western ideas. The Nazis didn't just look at the Jim Crow law and segregation, they also studied American race law, American law to do with indigenous people, American colonial law, and laws around marriage and property as well. The actual policymakers of the Nazi regime learned a lot from the United States because America was the world leader of race law at that time. And at times, the Nazis actually thought American law around the one-drop rule and other forms of segregation was actually too harsh. And in the end, Nazi lawyers and jurists rejected American race law for being too extreme.
That's Omar Aziz, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Omar Aziz on fascism in America. The term fascism is loosely bandied about. When most people think of it, the images that come to mind are of stormtroopers and Hitler ranting and raving. It's often automatically assumed that fascism developed in Europe in the 1920s, but it had its origins earlier in the United States. The United States was built on genocidal attacks on indigenous people, white supremacy, and enslaved black people. Actually, Hitler and the Nazis were greatly impressed and inspired by American fascism. Though the term was not used, the United States had developed a sophisticated system of aggressive nationalism, racism, and oppression. In other words, fascism. It lingers in the shadows and reappears, as is evident today. Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, and other groups are fascist. They fear social equality as a threat to patriarchal white supremacist domination. To talk about fascism in America is Omar Aziz. He's a writer, journalist, lawyer, and former foreign policy advisor in the administration of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He has clerked for the United Nations Special Envoy for Syria. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and many other publications. He spoke at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts in mid-April. And now, Omar Aziz.
Thank you to all of you for joining me today. You know, before I start, but I do want to answer the question of why I even pursued this project. You see, when I was growing up, I was told a lot of myths about the West, that it was the bastion of the Enlightenment and the age of reason and of civilized society. And I agreed with a lot of that. I went to some of the best schools. I'm here at Harvard. But I never quite understood how it was that the West, about 90 years ago, had sent its most assimilated, its most productive minority to the gas chambers. How had that happened? How had it happened that civilized, enlightened societies like Germany and like Italy had descended into the worst forms of barbarism and savagery that we had seen? Perhaps the roots of the problem didn't start in 1930. Perhaps the roots of this ideology we call fascism went a little deeper. And perhaps it was here in America as well. But before we understand what's going on right now, I think we need to take it all the way back. I want to lay out a definition very quickly because I think this is a core point that critics will jump on. Well, fascism is a term that everyone uses. It's used in online discourse, and it's not really defined. What is fascism? I define it as a far-right ideology. It's not a far-left ideology, as some critics have said. It's nationalistic, aggressively nationalistic. It's anti-democratic, right? There's a difference between being a nationalistic conservative and being a fascist. It embodies and glorifies the traditional masculine. It has a great nostalgia for the past. And it exercises a certain war over culture. And this is a theme that's going to come up in this presentation, and I hope in the discussion, in the ways in which fascists use culture, use art, use language, to essentially dominate the polity before they take over power. As Mussolini said, the fascist conception is a spiritual one, arising from the general reaction of the century against the materialistic positivism of the 19th century. Basically, it's a reactionary ideology. And no matter how we cut it, no matter how we slice it, no matter which example we look at, and over here we're going to look at the United States, Nazism, and a little bit of Italy, whether we look at Spain, whether we look at Vichy France, there's always an other. In theory, from a very theoretical standpoint, fascism could be state-based. Of course, Mussolini had said, only the state, nothing but the state, nothing outside of the state. But in practice, fascism leads to the marginalization and the demonization of an other, always. And one of the things I learned about more in my research about Nazism in Hitler's Germany was the virulent anti-Semitism, of course, that targeted the Jewish people, but also the anti-black racism, the targeting of what we would today call trans people, the targeting of intellectually disabled people, and of course, immigrants and foreigners. So regardless of who exactly the other is, it'll transform, but it's always there. And I want someone to try and challenge it. If one part of the legacy of the West was the Enlightenment, here was the other. White supremacy and fascism put into practice. Fascism was not just in the recent past of the West, it was practically tradition. Nazism in particular was the mutation and is the mutation of fascism that I am most interested in because of its focus on racial supremacy and of course it being the ultimate evil that we can conceive of. So I found some headlines and one of the things I found was that people here, and most people, of course, were white and they weren't of a minority group that would be persecuted by this individual, didn't really take his rise too seriously. They just kind of shrugged it off. Hitler's anti-Semitism, not so violent or genuine as it sounded, New York Times. This is a professor of mine from Yale Law School who, building on this thesis, this idea that basically the Nazis are operating within the Western tradition. They're not some evil, demonic group that emerged out of nowhere. That's very easy for us and self-satisfying for us to believe, but they're operating within the Western tradition. And this is something that I wrote a few years ago, just looking at the legal relationship between what the Nazis learned, what the Nazis implemented in their policy and what they took from the United States. Some of the Nazi inspirations actually surprised me. Hitler writes about this in Mein Kampf, and it's cited in The War in the East, the original racial supremacy, point by point. He studied and they studied and took great fascination in the American conquest of indigenous and Indian lands. That was the premise of Lebensraum or living space in the East, the Wild West mythology. Hitler was a huge fan of the cowboy myth, which was also a racial supremacist myth, American domination over blacks, of course. Second-class citizenship. Another thing that surprised me, the British Empire. Hitler and his cronies look out at what are called free white man's democracies in the early 1900s, not just the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. These are all states that have a racial caste system based upon white supremacy. America, of course, is the apogee of that and the example of a racial supremacist state at this time par excellence. Going through more of the headlines, no one's apparently surprised. And this is one thing that was perhaps surprising to me, given how history went afterwards, was that all of this was written about. Like, there was nothing here that was a secret. The party program in 1919, it says very, very clearly, only members of the nation may be a state. Accordingly, no Jew may be a member of the nation. It was very, very clearly written. But one thing that wasn't so clear was that how this individual was able to gain power. Now, in my research, I'm very interested in the early period of Nazism and fascism, because this is the transition period, right? This is where, in Italy, a democracy goes to a fascist state in the 1920s, and in Germany, it goes from a weak democracy, Weimar, into a full-blown fascist Nazi state very, very quickly. So 1939 and 1945 is not exactly the focus of my project. My focus is on the early part of the history to see how that transition happens. And one of the things I've learned through my research was that it really came down to the 30 days before Hitler assumed power in the backroom deals that happened in Berlin at the time. And that shows that at any point before that, this actually could have been stopped and that the people in the room, the decisions that they make are pivotal. This is another really interesting thing. This is also from the late Professor Henry Ashby Turner of Yale University, that no one who appointed Hitler chancellor had read any of his work in the room. They hadn't consulted any of the experts. They actually didn't know who they were getting into bed with, so to speak. This is super interesting as well. The German electoral history leading up to the Nazi ascension of power. Remember, Hitler takes power January 30th, 1933, 90 years ago this past January. And they weren't really doing that well. You know, the 1928 election, less than 3% of the vote, but they begin to build momentum. 1930 election, 18.4% of the vote. 1932 election, it goes up again. And there's another election in 1932, but the Nazi Party is going down at this point. They're losing seats, and through various backroom deals, Hitler is appointed chancellor. So this is my first lesson. When the fascists do get into power, they learn where the levers of control are and how to exercise them. They can and will transform the polity very quickly. January 30th, 1933 is a pivotal date in the 20th century. Hitler is appointed chancellor. Then there's the Reichstag fire. In February, the Enabling Act is passed in March, and by summer, there is no more German democracy. And one can argue this is a weak democracy, this was a democracy fated to fail, but I wouldn't bet too much on that argument either. Germany also had a proud tradition of not just militarism, but a legal culture as well. The legal German tradition went back hundreds of years. And this is why it was important, because Hitler actually didn't proclaim a new constitution. He was operating within the Weimar Constitution. But of course, Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution gives power to presidential rule by presidential decree. This is one of my core conclusions, I think, early on. I just want to state this. I was thinking about how a lot of right-wing politicians will come to this. They focus on the Marxists and the communists and basically a non-entity. I think this is one difference between communism as an idea and movement and fascism as an idea and movement. Communism launches the revolution. And then it wins power. I think of Lenin and the party state. I think of 1917. Whereas fascism wins power first, then it launches a revolution. It's very different, right? After Hitler's failed beer hall putsch attempt, the Nazis learn, you have to be quiet and you have to win power first. I want to go back to 1933 for a second and what the Nazis learned about America. Because the common narrative is that America went into Europe and saved Europe from Nazism and fascism, which is totally false. But going back to 1933, something very interesting happens in the Prussian ministry after Hitler's already taken power, which is that a memorandum circulates among Nazi lawyers. And what are they studying and looking at in this memorandum? They're studying American race law. And the very first thing that is cited in that memorandum and in that meeting is American race law over Jim Crow. The 1933 Prussian memorandum lays out what would become the Nuremberg Laws, the first law less known about the flag law, which based the swastika, the national flag of Germany, and better known about the citizenship law and the blood law, essentially forbidding Jews from becoming citizens and criminalizing marriage between Jews and Germans. Very interesting encounter that happens around this time at this meeting. Dr. Mobius, who's a Nazi doctor working for the Interior Ministry, talks to State Secretary Roland Freisler. He says, "I'm reminded of something an American said to us recently. He explained, we do the same thing you are doing, but why do you have to say it so explicitly in your law?" Freisler responded, "But the Americans put it in their own laws even more explicitly." This is the operative passage from Mein Kampf. And what Hitler is referring to here in particular is America's racially restrictive immigration laws. As we will see, the Nazis didn't just look at the Jim Crow law and segregation, they also studied American race law, American law to do with indigenous people, American colonial law, and laws around marriage and property as well. There are so many things like this. I don't want to continue beating this point, but I think it's an important one that the actual policymakers of the Nazi regime learned a lot from the United States because America was the world leader of race law at that time. And this was a startling conclusion Professor Whitman had as well, Yale Law School. He not only found that the Nazis studied American race law, he found that the most radical Nazis were the most aggressive champions of that race law. And at times, the Nazis actually thought American law around the one-drop rule and other forms of segregation was actually too harsh. You have to be reminded that the one-drop rule would have classified. The reason why it wasn't put into statute or into any laws or into any constitution was because, as strict as it was, as soon as that was put into legislation, many white people would be considered black. And in the end, Nazi lawyers and jurists rejected American race law for being too extreme. A little bit of history here. I think most people would know this. In 1691, Virginia adopts America's first race-based and anti-miscegenation statute. 1791, the very first Congress and their very first immigration law passed said that only free, quote, white persons could immigrate to the United States. Alex taught us yesterday about eugenics, and eugenics wasn't just operative in music, but in basically all fields, in all fields of policy, in everything to do with the human being at the time. And of course, America was the leader in eugenics research. And the eugenics movement at this time, again, in the 1920s, leads to this Immigration Restriction Act of 1924. One of the latest Immigration Restriction Acts sets a racial restrictive quota on immigration, bans entire populations, and basically America has a racist immigration policy until all the way until 1965. The way it has racist policy with marriage all the way until Loving versus Virginia in 1967. Very, very, very late. And this is the actual bill itself. It says right up top, those that any alien other than an alien enemy being a free white person. So that's super interesting when we talk about white supremacy, right? Because often critics say, well, it's just this generic, vague term. And yet there it is in the Congress. And we'll see that term comes up again and again. This Indian gentleman, in a case that has not been taught in law school, and this is a bone I have to pick with our law professors and curriculum makers, because neither Johnson versus McIntosh, which is the major Supreme Court case that lays out the reasoning for why and how America dominated the indigenous and stole their land, not taught. And this isn't taught either. We have this gentleman, Bhagat Singh Thind, who serves in World War I. He wants to become an American citizen. And he basically says, well, look, under the law, I'm an Aryan because I came from North India, and therefore I'm a pure blood Aryan. And this is the argument that he tries to make. And the court actually agrees with him at the lower level. They say, according to our own racist genealogy, this is not what they said exactly, but according to our own genealogy and according to our own anthropology and according to our own pseudoscience, yes, you are an Aryan. But the Supreme Court, they basically decided, well, you do not look like a white person the way we understand it, so therefore we cannot classify you as white. This is actually a major problem in American race law and American history, that despite white supremacy, the definition of whiteness itself is always vague and always shifting. And this is what the Supreme Court justice said, that free white persons need to be interpreted according to the understanding of the common man, synonymous with the word Caucasian, only as that word is popularly understood, because actually they lost the argument on the merits. More racially restrictive laws. I mean, the Cable Act gives women the right to retain their citizenship after they get married to non-citizen men. Except there's an racial restriction that's set up right here, and it says if you marry an Asian man who's a non-citizen and you're a woman, your citizenship still will be stripped from you until 1930 as well. And the Nazis are studying all this. You know, American race law doesn't just exist on Jim Crow. It exists across the spate of all American laws. If you think of indigenous law, it's colonial law. If you think of segregation laws, those are separate but equal, very strict. Of course, voting laws, immigration laws we discussed, very racially restrictive, all citizenship laws, all marriage laws, and of course, all property laws. All of them have racial restrictions and white supremacy written into them. The big difference that the Nazis understood was that whereas they put it explicitly in their own laws, American judges and jurists had a way of reconciling the 14th Amendment, equality before the law, and racial white supremacy. They found what the Nazis called, quote, devious pathways. They found ways, as you know, those of us who are lawyers, we know you can get around anything, but they found actual interpretive methodological ways to get around the principle of equality to the point where it really didn't matter. I have to quote here John Marshall Harlan, his famous dissent, where he says, our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. In respect of civil rights, all citizens are equal before the law. It's a famous passage that's quoted often in law school. I view it as an aspirational statement that clearly had no basis in reality at the time. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments expand equality, of course, but as we'll see, you know, the original Constitution had white supremacy written right into it, and the Nazis understood this. They cited all kinds of American law. And I view this as the core tension in my work here, the tension between these two ideas, the emancipatory universal idea and the race-based white supremacist idea. Constitution of the United States, again, much of this is probably familiar to people, but of course the Electoral College is based on white supremacy and protecting slaveholders. Former professor of mine, Akhil Rita Mar, has very persuasively argued this, and others, the Fugitive Slave Clause, the Slave Trade Clause, which bans Congress from restricting the international slave trade for 20 years. I mean, these guys really went all the way. And ultimately what this does is it tilts the power of American democracy into the hands of an enslaver's oligarchy. And this is another provocation I do want to throw out, and I welcome any questions on this or any comments on this, on whether the white South could be considered fascist. And my argument here is, if it seems to have fascist white supremacist laws and it talks like a fascist and a white supremacist, it might be a fascist and white supremacist. Down in the South, we all know this. I was just in Georgia recently. I was in Savannah, Georgia, actually a beautiful city. And right there is a huge Civil War monument. And one of the things I was struck by, and commentators note this, is just the grandness of the monument. It wasn't even to a particular individual. It was just to the Confederates, and the thing just kept going up. And I thought, this is, of course, a form, to me, I thought fascism right away. So, of course, there's other citizenship laws here. Basically, America creates an entirely new citizenship regime as it conquers Puerto Rico, as it conquers the Philippines. It creates second-class citizenship, third-class citizenship for black people, Native Americans, Puerto Ricans, Filipinos, and all the colonial subjects. Point that I do want to emphasize is that the anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic policy of the Nazis doesn't exist in a vacuum. And I mention this because I was at a talk with the former Attorney General, Mr. Jeffrey Rosen. And it was a talk on anti-Semitism, even though I wanted to ask him about January 6th, which we'll get to, because he was the Attorney General at the time. But everyone seemed to just be obtuse to the fact that the President of the United States had said there were very fine people on both sides regarding neo-Nazis, and that there was a longer history here of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish policy that doesn't begin 20 years ago or 30 years ago. Again, the conversation I felt was very myopic. So conspiracy theory, of course, is tied to anti-Semitism, that a small population controls the world, and media and finance, etc. Tropes of Jewish success. Jews were less than 0.75% of the German population in 1933. So that was something that was surprising to me as well, that there were roughly, according to the U.S. Holocaust Museum, only roughly around 500,000 Jews living in Germany around the time Hitler ascended to power. So being small in number really doesn't matter to the white supremacists. And of course, the uncomfortable fact, going back to my original question of how the West had descended into such savagery and barbarism, is 2,000 years of anti-Semitism repeated at the pulpit day after day, week after week, for centuries and for millennia, repeating the worst tropes of Jewish, anti-Jewish hatred for centuries. And this was in the cultural, intellectual soil of Germany when Hitler assumes power. Another important point that was noted in a lot of the research I've been doing was just the severity of the anti-black racism, the severity of the hatred for Eastern races, so-called Eastern races, the targeting of the intellectually challenged, and of course, control over women's bodies. Nazis began to enforce very, very strictly abortion laws in Germany by the September of 1933. Some judges would make exceptions later on for minority women, Jewish women, but it was part of their policy, their family planning policy, their policy of control over the state. You must control women's bodies. And this is a recurring theme that the fascists always, always will return to. And of course, the sterilization policy. A lot of this was taken directly from the United States. I want to emphasize this point as well, because some might ask why I'm again studying this and emphasizing it. I want to start looking at the ideas of 1933 and how those policies morph over time, right? The policy of the Nazi Party is not extermination in 1933. That's just not factually true. It is deportation, it is segregation, it is exclusion, it is all these other things. But there's a path to dependence here, right? We begin by marginalizing a minority, dehumanizing them over and over again in the press. Then we talk about violence against them. Then we can segregate them. Very nearly it leads in all fascist regimes to the worst possible outcome, and in this case was, of course, the Shoah. This is the mechanisms that I'm working on, from ideas to action to political momentum to policy, and the idea that policy can and will radicalize and harden over time. So once again, to repeat, Nazism draws from a deeper wellspring of Western ideas, and they keep coming up, the rejection of progress, rejection of exchange of ideas, belief in one-man rule representing the pure race, racism and anti-Semitism, and of course, xenophobia. The Nazis were operating within the Western tradition. It's why their party structure may have gone away, but their ideas have not. Just some factual reminders that before the Nazis came to power, 28 U.S. states passed sterilization laws. Before the Nazis had come to power, More than 15,000 people sterilized in the first wave of this, by the way. Swiss sterilization laws also existed in Nordic countries like Denmark, Norway, Switzerland as well. Of course, the literacy test, another racial restriction introduced into the emancipatory idea of American law. Something very interesting about the literacy test, which we think of as exclusively a post-Civil War implementation in the South, was that it actually started in the North, in Connecticut and in Massachusetts, as a way to racially restrict immigration without explicitly saying so. Right? So this is how you ensure Irish and Italians and others cannot come to your state, by introducing a literacy test. And of course, the literacy test from the 1850s then is considered very, very popular in the South and is introduced in a number of states to disenfranchise black people. 30 American states banned mixed marriages before the Nazis came into power, and criminalization of marriage in legal history is very, very rare. So I kind of want to go to this now, because I don't have that much time, but I do want to note how Harvard was complicit in Nazism and in fascism. In 1934, the Harvard class of 1909 welcomed back one of its famous alumni, who then was serving as Nazi press chief, Ernest Hahnfenstengel. The Nazi official came to campus. He had tea with Harvard's president. Two women chained themselves to the Harvard railing. At one point, a local rabbi approached him and accosted him and said, "My people want to know, does it mean extermination?" Hahnfenstengel replied coldly, "I'm on vacation. I'm with my old friends." And this reminds me of the many dignitaries and war criminals and various associates of war criminals who pass through elite institutions, and everyone just claps and no one asks them a single difficult question. Harvard Crimson denounced the anti-Nazi protests as childish. And even up until 2005, you see in the Harvard Crimson rationalizations for this, justifications for this. Well, Harvard never explicitly condoned Nazism, but it subscribed to the genteel anti-Semitism that pervaded the elite institutions of the country in the early years of the 20th century. This is from the Third Reich in the Ivory Tower, and those who are interested can read more about it. But I thought that it was particularly disgusting that the Crimson also called for an honorary degree to be given to the individual. The dean of the Harvard Law School as well, very famous individual in the legal academy named Dean Roscoe Pound, big fan of Adolf Hitler and also thinks Hitler should be given an honorary degree. So the point here is the smartest people in the smartest institution where we are sitting as well didn't see it as a problem, right? Perhaps we should, before we even talk about a racist policy or a sexist policy or a misogynistic policy, the first people we should ask are the ones who are going to be impacted by it, not the majority white men who are sitting around making a lot of those policies. If we're going to actually introduce a voice into the narrative, it should be the one who will be impacted by it. Because I can guarantee you there were probably Jews in America at that time when that Nazi was visiting who were very, very, very afraid. Lesson number two, platforming the far right legitimizes them. Ideas and movements are given credibility, they're given credence, they're given shine by proximity to elite institutions. I want to come to the story of now. Because, unfortunately, when I came to Harvard, I would have been fine writing a purely historical work, looking at scholarship, looking at law, looking at research. I was reading Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville, and he was writing about the three races and the subjugation of the three races in America. And that was the day that January 6th actually happened. But something closer to home happened as well, because apparently the Nazis haven't gone away. Just a few months ago, right here in our own very neighborhood, neo-Nazis were here assaulting, attacking students, shouting slurs, part of a neo-Nazi outfit called the Nationalist Socialist 131 Crew. Unfortunately, this is not theory. These people didn't go away, they just seem to have reassembled. And even though there is no Nationalist Socialist German Workers' Party or an Italian Fascist Party as they existed at the time, their ideas are still with us and very easily retrievable on the internet, by the way. And the more that we in the sort of mainstream are afraid to tackle these ideas and confront them and challenge them and push back, the more these ideas fester. So this is how you have many, many, too many young white men who are turning into fascists.
You're listening to Omar Aziz on Fascism in America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.